following is Olga Howard's talk, Solving World Problems with UX, from the 2011 Information Architecture Summit. The 2011 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by UIE's User Experience Training Library, with scores of online seminars your team can access on demand. Hear the field's top experts on timely topics and the current design challenges you're facing. Get a free UIE virtual seminar at uie.com/IAS11.
My name is Olga Howard. My day job is UX lead at 3Pillar Global. They're a technology consultancy firm, product-based. It's the concept that 3Pillar works with is not that we're working on projects, but that we're working on products. But what I'm here to talk to you all about today is not related to my day job. It's really part of my passion in getting UX to help anywhere it can. And so I am actually wearing what's supposed to be a dress from early 1920s. I'll be talking about a woman named Gertrude Bell. And this is what she wore. And the reason why I'm wearing it is because I'm going to show you what kind of person she was and what she had to do to make her user experience better in her own personal life. So, in working in user experience at 3Pillar, I suspect that you all have to do this too. One of the challenges we have to face is try to create a common language. What is user experience? And not just for your internal purposes for your company, but also how you speak to your clients, how you communicate that to anyone who asks you, what do? So for me and for my group at 3Pillar Global, I decided that what I needed to do is to deconstruct what user experience is so that we may then make decisions about how we communicate it and make decisions about what particular elements of user experience we want to use. So it looks kind of like a science table of elements. And this actually worked very well within the company. And it allowed us to actually have discussions about the different parts. The one element that we're going to talk about today is the first one, which is task analysis. And you'll see the descriptions of what each of those elements actually mean on the bottom. I'll be able to share this slide with you all so you don't have to write all of those things down. You could just take it with you. But the idea is to make it your own and create your own table of elements so that you can have those discussions with your folks to create that common language that we often are missing. And in taking that common language outside of the workspace and into education, I've done a little bit of work to try to figure out, is there a user experience common language in education? And the answer was definitely not. I'll tell you a little story about why I wanted to do this. When my daughter was in third grade, she came home crying one day, and she was very upset. I could tell she was very anxious. And she could not explain to me what she was feeling or why. But at the end of the day, what she explained was that she had so many things to do, she could not possibly finish them. So if you probably have had that feeling, maybe you're working with a lot of projects, and you have this tightness in your chest, you're not going to finish it, and you need more time. And that's kind of the feeling that she was having. So I said to myself, you're only in third grade. You shouldn't be having those feelings. It's a horrible thing to do to a kid. So how many of you in the audience have a child? Maybe there is a niece or a nephew. Is there a child in your life? So if you think about it, most folks in this room actually raised their hand. So that means that everything that we can do to help that social problem is going to affect every one of us, our children, our grandchildren, and beyond. So that's why I feel it's very important for us to extend this common language of what is user experience outside of our workspace, of our technology, of our architecture, and into the social sphere, and see if we can help them out. See if we can do something about it. And I can tell you that there is no common language right now. I've talked with many parents, I've talked with many teachers, and I've talked with folks who live both in the county I live in and outside of the county I live in. And the one thing that came out very strongly was this problem of communications that they have. This particular guy is my son that you see in the slide, and he is the communications delivery guy at my home. So the teacher, the school, gives him all the papers that I need to sign. I mean, these are important things. He brings them home, and he never gives them to me, ever. So every day, I have to go and ask, did you have any papers for me? No, Mom, of course not. The next morning, I open his stuff up to put his lunch in, and there they are. And of course, I have no time to deal with that. So we have to work on that problem. Anyone here have that same experience where the child actually brings home all these really important papers? So we have to work on that. Now, one of my early readings that really made me think about user experience and how user experience actually does work to solve problems was Gertrude Bell. I'm wearing her outfit right now. She used to wear long skirts. And that was her life. But she was a very, very different kind of person. She was not made for her time. She was very smart, and she was a mountain explorer. She was very wealthy, so she had the opportunity to go out and do all these things. And when you read about her, and you should, because she was amazing, you'll find a couple of things. One is that she was a spy. Another was that she was a mountain climber. And you can imagine what that would be like with this outfit I'm wearing. So what they say about her is that she used to climb mountains in her underwear, because it's true. And she didn't care, and so she would go out to the mountain, and she'd take off her skirt. If you can imagine me wearing the pantaloons that they did before, she'd take it off, and then she was ready to climb. And she wasn't allowed, obviously, to show herself that way in the public. So she would wait until she got to the mountain, the face of the mountain, and take it off. And it worked well. She was actually the first woman to climb the Swiss Alps in her underwear. So that's the kind of woman she was. And I believe that's the kind of people we need to be. Just forget about the rules that exist today and try to solve the problems that we're faced with. How did she do this? Now, one of the questions that always comes up is, what is user experience? Where did it come from? And in the table of elements that I showed you in the beginning, that's what we think of today in terms of user experience. It's an umbrella, and it has a bunch of little items on the bottom, some methods that we use, some tricks of the trade, and we decide which of those tricks of the trade are relevant for the particular problem we're trying to solve. But I believe that user experience has existed since the beginning of man, because this is a human construct. We just never called it that. And we know this because just recently, I'm going to say just recently, because user experience previous to the term being used prominently, we used to say information architecture. Then we had the conversation about interaction design. So I say forget the name, and let's just say that we are going to solve problems with some very specific methods. So what she did, and I'm using the little task analysis element there, because that what she was trying to do without knowing it is she was coming to what is what we call today's task analysis. First of all, she was not planning on becoming a spy. But what happened was that she was passionate about traveling through Arabia. And in her travels, she was alone. She would hire tribesmen to go with her, to be in her caravan. And as a woman, she would meet, if you can imagine, back in those days, the different tribes that existed in different places. And she would get into trouble because she was a woman in the first place. And there were tribe factions, and there were wars, and all those kinds of things. So what she did is, first she learned the language. She learned their common language. But she didn't just learn the language. She learned their Arab poetry. So when she was stopped by a chieftain, she would then have a conversation with the chieftain, and she would speak the poetry. And they were so impressed by her that they took her into their wing and they would protect her until she got to the next tribe. So this was her life as she went through this area. But what she was doing is she was learning a common language, and she was, in essence, living within the tribes and understanding them, which is very similar to what we do today, what we try to do today. When she talked to the chieftains in their language, she interviewed them, not in the way that we are thinking about today, but she, in essence, learned about them and what they do and what's important to them. So when the government learned that she had this experience, that she understood the tribes, that she was able to speak the Arabic language and all of their dialects and the poetry, they hired her to become a spy. You don't really hear a lot about her today because of the fact that Lawrence of Arabia, he's the guy who takes all the credit, but she was his counterpart. So she was the analyst who would bring him the information, and then he would go out and hang out with the tribes and take a lot of pictures and be famous. There's a lot of conversation around whether or not she was as influential in the forming of all the countries in Iraq, but she was. And this is why they came to her, because she knew what task analysis should be when they were trying to figure out what countries should be and who should lead them. So when we're thinking about research methods, there are a lot of research methods. I've taken this one just to show an example of kind of where we land most of the time. When we have interviews, or at least it's been my experience, that when I have interviews with users, we tend to have a conversation that's very open, and we talk about pain points, we talk about maybe some things they'd like to see, and we get into this process of having them tell us kind of what they want when it should be the opposite, the other way around. We should be telling them what they should want, right? Because we know. And so while this particular method where we're talking, and in this slide you're seeing the frequently asked questions, that's a really good way to figure out what the problems are. We have some ideas and some common problems. It kind of fits that mold. Well, I've recently started working on what is called outcome-driven innovation. And what this says to us is bring it up a notch, bring it up a level, and don't try to solution when you're talking to users. Listen very carefully to what they're saying and try to come up with outcomes. So I'm going to show you an example of what that means. I'm not going to be able to actually tell you much about this because it's very in-depth, and what you should do is take a look at those books, What Customers Want and Service Innovation. Read them so you can understand what this process is about, but I'll give you an idea of why I think it's a really important way of trying to figure out what users need. And this is very specific to the idea of innovation. It has a very specific language. And it's a little bit difficult, actually, when you first get started doing this kind of stuff, because it seems so simple that it can't possibly work. So within this process, you have 8 steps as you see them now, and you have the possibility that there is a problem that needs to be resolved as you move through the process. But it's very specific to saying that you have to have a job. So when you have an interview with someone and they say something like, I need to communicate better, or my email system always breaks, or what's a common one? Someone give me a common problem that usually comes up.
I can't find the policy for this.
Okay, so it was, I can't find the policy for that. That's a really good one, actually. When that person tells you that, you have to ask them, well, what is it that your job should be if you can't find the policy for something? So the job might be something like, find a policy. Very simple. I just need to find a policy. Well, then what you're supposed to do is take that job and break it into all these steps and say, okay, well, how does it start? It starts by this. And maybe an example might be, it starts by there being a policy, right? So if there is a policy, if there isn't a policy, then you have a related job, which is you have to write a policy. Then you take that out as another job, right? So you just kind of move down the line, and let's say that a policy does exist, then you have to go into each one of these steps and you say, what is the outcome that you need to have in all those items? So I'll give you an example right now of what that means and how it's used. So I had several interviews with teachers about their lives. They're feeling a little bit, I should say, nervous about the world that exists today, because teachers were bashed for such a long time, and I think they still are, although we're coming around to trying to help them a little bit more. But the idea with these interviews, I was trying to figure out, what jobs are you actually trying to do? Without taking all of the politics aside, just what are you trying to do? Get down to the meat of it. So for this particular teacher, she was a substitute, and she wanted to become a substitute teacher. There are two types of teachers, just to be clear. There are short-term teachers, and then there are long-term teachers. A long-term teacher would be 2 weeks or longer. But a substitute teacher can choose any role. So I asked her, well, how does it start? Well, very similar to any other job is you apply for it. And what was interesting is that what she said, I asked her specifically, is there anything that you need to do to apply to do all of this? And what she said was that, well, people need to know me. So even if I apply, nobody knows me. So it doesn't matter unless I go out there and I talk to people. And it's very similar to what we do. So, you know, it makes sense. Okay. The next thing that she has to do is to gather lessons. So when you're looking at the different elements in apply, you would have to say, the language that you use in the outcomes is, you would have to say is, maybe decrease the time it takes to apply. You're never supposed to solution. Or increase the possibility that I will be able to apply. So that has its own connotations altogether. And that's why this is a great process to go through, because you're not solutioning, and the solution could be anything, depending on where you are and what the circumstance is. For gathering lessons, the simplistic approach is decrease the time it takes for me to find lessons for this class. So she's been hired. Now she goes into the class. Where are the lessons? Decrease the time it takes for me to find those lessons. And if none exist, then it would be decrease the time it takes for me to create these lessons. So very simple language that does not solution, and you have an outcome. So that's really what you're trying to get at. And the next step for her was that she had to set up a grading system. So decrease the time it takes for me to set up the grading system. Well, if you take that by itself and you go, well, what is the grading system? You have a huge problem that you need to solve, right? It really depends, because I know that Lori Cavallucci, who's sitting here, she's actually helping me with this project as well. And she did her own research. And we then compared notes, and we realized that in my county, the communications is different. The way that parents communicate with the schools is different. And then even there is no common language between counties. So how do we deal with that? And that has a lot to do with the history of education, where it came from, how it started. So setting up a grading system would be next. The next thing I asked, well, who validates? And now these steps are very specific. You have to ask that question. There has to be some validation. Because the idea at the end of the day is that you need to be able to be successful at this task. You cannot drop anything. So when I asked this question, she said, well, nobody validates it. They just assume that I know what I'm doing. And being a teacher who's subbing maybe in different schools and knowing that now I know that schools work differently, they have very different policies. Well, does that actually work? And no, it doesn't. And what she said was, it was very much a sink or swim situation. Nobody gives me lessons, and I just go. And what she does is actually she goes out to understand what the Virginia standards. So imagine someone here in Denver who is put in that situation. She has to then understand the Denver policies and standards for this school system. So all of the school systems have very different things to do. And then she has to teach the lessons. So obviously here, this is where we get into the meat of the matter. When she's teaching these lessons, they're very specifically tied to the lessons that she's put together or she's gathered or somebody has given her. So what happens when she's teaching these lessons to this group of students that she doesn't know? When you move into the area of teaching the lesson and your outcome might be decrease the time it takes to teach this lesson, you're not going to be successful if you don't know the students and what their levels of learning are, especially if you've had to make your own. So what she said to me was that the problem lies in understanding that, what are those levels that exist today. So decreasing the time it takes to understand the knowledge base that these students have. Then moving into monitoring the lessons, that's another step you must have. Well, did the lesson actually work? Well, it probably didn't. If you don't know what these students' levels of learning are, where they are in the process. Then you go into modify the lessons, and imagine this system working for any project you have. You really just go step by step, try to get out the outcomes, and work with those outcomes to figure out where the problems lie. So she modifies the lessons, and then she comes back to, if you see the circle, it just goes over and over again. At the end of the year, they have to close a student record, which basically states the student learned this and all of that. So where we fall and where this process is really good is in taking us up that notch, not asking what the solution should be, but actually asking, what do you really want to do? So where this is important for us in innovation and why I like this is because we can take all of those pieces and simplify them so much that we can get an answer for that without clouding it with the bigger concepts of what's going on and all of this stuff. In terms of, if I was to take this interview with this teacher, the next thing that you really need to do, one is look at where the problems are for yourself. But you're not really done with this process until you send out a survey. You have all of your outcomes in a list. You send out a survey to others of the same, let's say for the teachers it would be, you would send out for a survey to substitute teachers, because this is the job that we're trying to get at. If you're thinking about maybe for a product, and this is a product for maybe parents, and parents need to understand the grading system or what the grade might be of their student, then you have a different problem that you're going to solve. But you would send it to the same audience and you would ask these questions. You would say, how important is this outcome to you? Because we are only going to interview 10 people. It takes a really long time to do this. So you want to interview at least 10 people, 10 to 12 people. And then you're going to take those outcomes and you're going to send them out to about 180. I think it's about 180. I'll have to look at those numbers again, but it's not a large number. And what you ask is, how important is this to you? Is this outcome satisfied in the market today? And if it is, how well does it satisfy you? How well does that tool work today in the marketplace? So what you're supposed to get out of that is, one, how important is this? If it's not that important, then you can choose to leave that alone, put it on the side for a while. If it's satisfied, if, for example, the lessons, let's say that an outcome for the grading system is decrease the time it takes for me to understand the grading system, and you send that out to a bunch of substitute teachers and they come back to say, yeah, I understand it. Well, then you don't have to do anything with that. You just put it to the side. But when you send out something about the lessons, decrease the time it takes for me to create a lesson, and it comes back to, no, I'm not satisfied because it takes me forever. This teacher actually told me that she went into school every Sunday the whole time she was subbing because there was no way she could get it done. So then those surveys come back to you and you know where you want to put your money and your resources. And that's where innovation comes in. And so the idea is, if something is satisfied, this is your opportunity to put a lot of money into that to become an emergent technology, to make something better that exists today. And you can decide that that's what you want to do. Or on the other side is, you can decide that you want to leave it alone. Where I think we as a UX community can really help out is in understanding and helping the rest of the world understand where the problems lie. We don't have to solution it, because that's going to happen by somebody else. But if they understand that the problem lies in the lessons, in creating these lessons, that teachers are going to school every Sunday for free to create these lessons to teach your children, then we can make something out of that, make it important, bring it up a notch, bring it up in the priority list for everyone who is affected by education, which is really everyone. Are there any questions? I know this is really tough because of the fact that it's a very deep process, but I want to make sure that I kind of explain it to you and let you know how I'm using it, but it can be used for anything. So when you look at this, I can tell you that the innovation is already out there for these lessons. When I did this, I was like, oh, now it makes sense why a company like K-12 is doing so well, because all they do is they create these lessons. And so they're growing big time because they've satisfied this problem of lesson creation. So we can look at this process for whatever project we're working on, whatever product we're working on, and we can say the innovation for this product is going to come out where these problems live. And we can use it for anything. That's why I'm saying it's really, you can solve world problems with this. Are there any questions at all? Any thoughts, ideas? Stacy, I see you confused.
Maybe I'm stuck in the example that you gave, mm-hmm. but to me, I don't see how this is different than simple problem solving. And you keep repeating the importance of not solutioning during the process.
Right.
And I guess I'm not getting it.
Well, it's actually really hard because it took me a while. We're used to using tools like user stories. And at first, when I was first looking at this, it's very much a user story problem, right? It's task analysis at its best. The difference lies in not getting confused in jobs, the specific tasks that need to be done. And this allows you to separate all the jobs. So becoming a substitute teacher becomes its own little ball. And it does not get mixed in with becoming a teacher. Or it does not mixed in with creating a lesson. Creating a lesson becomes its own job because it has a whole other set of rules and ideas and thoughts that need to go into that. That's where it comes in. But it's very similar to using user stories. It just takes it up a notch and allows you to not get confused because it's really easy to mix concepts, ideas, problems. And I did it a lot in the beginning when I first started doing this. It took me a little while to get used to it and to actually do it well. But now that I'm more able to follow through on this notion of not mixing the concepts, not missing the jobs, I can see a little bit clearer now. So I can say with certainty that the innovation is going to come out of these lessons. And it's not until I was able to do that that I could clearly see where we needed to work, where the problems lied.
You mentioned that you interviewed about 10 to 12 teachers and then surveyed about 180. For a project that I would work on, say, in a for-profit company, how long would 10 to 12 interviews take? And then the survey, like what kind of effort mm-hmm. goes into this?
This is a very big effort, and it's one of the drawbacks of this process. It takes a long time. And it takes a long time because you have to be very careful about the language you use and where you guide the user. So I'll give you an example of the teachers. I would sit for an hour with them, and I'd have conversations. And there are very specific questions that you need to ask, like, for example, how does this start? So you don't forget that there is a start. And you go through this process of asking all of these questions. The idea is to really try to make sure that you get information about all of these. So that's an hour. Then you take that interview and you take the steps, the apply, and then you have to work through what those outcomes are for that. It is a little difficult because some are so simplistic, like decrease the time it takes to apply to become a substitute teacher. That's very simplistic. But you can easily start getting into other things like increase the likelihood that teachers and those who hire principals know about me. So you can get into this idea of the social aspect, the emotional stories, the emotional pieces of it. All of these things come into play. So it does take a while. And then once you go through that process, although it takes a long time, you have so much knowledge from now until the future. The claim by these folks that wrote these books is that you have 5 years of work ahead of you by doing this one interview. And they're right. And the reason why they're right is because you've taken it and you've deconstructed it to every step, and you're never going to be able to finish it all. But you can take little pieces and you can work on those little pieces. So even though it takes a while in the beginning, at the end of the day, it's really worthwhile.
So maybe one way to characterize what this does and sort of to get at what Stacy was asking, maybe, and since I'm not a practitioner, I'm not sure what methods are already in place mm-hmm. that people commonly use in the room. But one way of characterizing this would be to say that this offers a pretty systematic framework to identify things and build it back up, whereas before, maybe you're just putting out fires or things come along and you address that because people are talking about it? Or are there already other systematic methods in place now?
Yeah, it's a very good notion of this idea of systematic. Who here works in Agile? Okay, so you know that there is a very specific system and you don't really escape that system in order to be successful in the Agile process. So it is exactly that notion that you can create a systematic way of getting at the problems and helping those who need to make decisions about what problems to solve have all the knowledge they need to say, yes, this is where I'm going to put my money. Because at the end of the day, it is really all about money. The teacher who goes to school every Sunday is working for free. You know, is it fair? Is it not? So yeah, it is a very systematic way of getting at that.
This reminds me a little bit of Indy Young's mental model process and her version of task analysis. And I think it would be neat to kind of take this and kind of do a mashup, because hers is all about making that horizon chart so you can see how each job kind of stacks together with the different task towers and whatnot. And it gets so fractal that you can just keep breaking them down. And I think there's a lot of synergy between those two methods.
Yeah, I agree. When I first started working on this, my initial want, my need was go directly to the mental model, because that's what I was working on before. And I still swear by the mental model. It's a really great tool that we can use for getting at what the task analysis should be. And I think you're right. I should look at how that might work with it, because in this mode, it's really hard to understand how that works. I guess the only difference would be when you put it into the mental model sphere, you would say that the outcomes might be the micro elements in the mental model. Yeah, I'll look at that. Thank you. Anyone else? I hope this was helpful to you. It's been very helpful to me. And although it takes time to understand this process, for things that are not technology related, that are related to how the world works and social problems, this is a really good way to try and figure out how to solve those things and to remove all the politics out of it.
I was just wondering if you could give us the authors for the two books, What Customers Want and Service Innovation.
There are two different authors, but if you go to Synergen, that's the company who...
Of course you do.
That's okay. Synergen. Actually, those two authors created a company called Synergen.
What are they?
And you'll see them.
Service Innovation is Lance Betancourt.
Service Innovation is Lance Betancourt and... Anthony Ulwick, U-L-W-I-C-K, for Service Innovation. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome. And those books...
That was for What Customers Want.
Yeah, those books are really important, especially if you think about the work that you do as a product, which is different than as pieces of product. So it brings you up a little bit higher in terms of how you think about what you're making. All right, well, I think that's all. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the 2011 IA Summit. For more great user experience design content, visit uie.com and sign up for our free newsletter, UIE Tips.